Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Mel Duncan. This is a project of www.beatitudescenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin with, as usual, with a little prayer. I invite everyone, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and to relax, and let's recenter ourselves and enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere. And let's welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus into our hearts here with us. Just take a moment to ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more and more and to do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, heal us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part to help end poverty, war, racism, greed, injustice, genocide, nuclear weapons, fascism, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers, your beloved sons and daughters, that we might welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, amen. Friends, it's a great blessing to welcome one of the great peacemakers of our times, my friend Mel Duncan. Mel has been a leader in developing the practice of unarmed civilian protection for decades. He actually started providing nonviolent protective presence along Nicaragua's northern border in 1984 during the U.S.-Contra War. In 2002, along with our friend David Hartso and Mary Lou Ott, he founded Nonviolent Peace Force, which I hope everyone will look up and study. The website is nonviolentpeaceforce.org, just as it sounds. Nonviolent Peace Forces, nonviolent civilian protectors, provide direct protection to civilians caught in violent conflict in war zones around the world. And they work with local groups there in war zones and conflict zones to prevent further violence and to sustain peace. And they've done this in South Sudan, to Ukraine, here in the U.S., to the Philippines. Mel has represented Nonviolent Peace Force at the United Nations, where they've been granted consultative status. Recent UN global reviews, as well as Security Council and General Assembly resolutions, have cited and recommended unarmed civilian protection, which is the real hallmark of the Nonviolent Peace Force and something Gandhi dreamed about early on. The American Friends Service Committee nominated Nonviolent Peace Force for the 2016 Nobel Peace Prize. And in fact, in 2018, they won the prestigious Luxembourg Peace Prize. Since retiring from Nonviolent Peace Force in 2023, Mel has helped organize a team of unarmed civilian protectors who are now working in the occupied territories of Palestine. It's called Unarmed Civilian Protection, UCP, in Palestine. He worked there for 6 months up through last year, and for the past few months during the ICE occupation, he has been providing protective presence at a high school in St. Paul, Minneapolis, where he's from. He's also served as the director of the Minnesota Alliance for Progressive Action, which is a coalition of labor unions, environmental, peace, and civil rights group. He's now, as I said, retired with his wife, Georgia, in St. Paul, where they raised 8 children and now 15 grandchildren. Mel Duncan, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you, John. I do feel welcome.
Good. You. Mel, you've been an activist and an organizer really your whole life. You were full on, even as a teenager in the 60s. Tell us about your journey and how your focus moved over the decades into organizing and leading to the co-creation of Nonviolent Peace Force.
As you said, John, I've always been an organizer. When I was 15, I was organizing around civil rights, and soon in opposition to the Vietnam War and draft resistance, and continuing that organizing throughout my life. And then in my 40s, I had a chance to spend a year at the University of Creation Spirituality, a school that was founded and led by Matthew Fox, who has been one of your guests here in the past. And it was during that time that I was confronted by a Sufi who was teaching there. And we had just started a class on Rumi, and we didn't know each other, but all of a sudden I looked up and she was staring into my eyes, and she said, "And your job is to enter the heart of your enemy." And I looked at her, and then I quickly looked and to check, and all my fellow classmates were there. And I looked back and I wanted to say, "Are you talking to me, lady?" And I wrote down in my book, in my notebook, "Enter the heart of my enemy. That's a good place to rip it out." And then later in the page, I wrote, "Don't go back to sleep. This could change your life." And up until that point, I always organized on good versus evil, right versus wrong, 50% plus one means we kick their butt. And from that moment, as the saying goes, when the student's ready, the teachers appear, I was challenged to my very core to start understanding life from a point of unity. And so from that confrontation by that Sufi, I was then led to start studying this Vietnamese monk that I'd never heard of, a guy by the name of Thich Nhat Hanh. And the school was such, I could read every book he wrote and have discussions and be challenged. A year later, I was sitting in Plum Village with Thich Nhat Hanh. And it was upon leaving Plum Village, riding a bus back to Paris, I wrote in my notebook the inspiration of a nonviolent peace force. And from there, I came back to Minnesota. I'd been working on a fellowship and joined Georgia and the kids. They had been with me for part of the time and then come back, and Georgia thankfully had started working again. But this vision wouldn't leave me. And so one day Georgia just said, "Go for it." And the next day in The Nation, there's this, the periodical The Nation, there's this article about the upcoming Hague Appeal for Peace. So as an organizer, I thought that'd be the place to check out the currency of this idea. And so I raised enough money for a plane ticket. I found a free place to stay in The Hague, and I was off. And that's where I met you in 1999. And there, in the form of a question, I heard a guy lay out the same vision. And so I pushed through the crowd. I grabbed him by the hand. And I said, "If you're serious about what you just said, we have to go start organizing." Well, that was David Herzl.
Wow, yeah.
And can you imagine saying to David Herzl, "Are you serious about what you just said?"
Yeah, that was a big mistake. David Herzl, to our listeners, was one of the great peacemakers of our time, who died last year and wasn't able to get him on the podcast, and just mythic figure who would work with Dr. King and started programs all over the country. You can't even begin to talk about them. So I remember, first of all, thank you for the story. I didn't know that. And we were probably there in the Bay Area at the same time. And I was blessed to know Thich Nhat Hanh for 30 years through Daniel Berg, and had many life-changing experiences with him. And I'm so glad you got to Plum Village. But I remember the day, I remember you at the Hague Appeal, which is every 100 years, there's a global gathering for peace. I think there were 10,000 people there.
Yes.
It was very exciting. And this was 1999 in The Hague. That's where I met Tutu, and became friends with him. in the hallway.
Yeah, but I ran into him on the stairway.
Yeah, yeah. You come into my office. I'm the director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, you and David, and you make this pitch for this new thing, the Nonviolent Peace Force, and I think you asked for money, and I was so excited and all for it, and I still am. I think it's one of the new great advances, if you will, in peacemaking in the world, and it's and you all have done such great work. And to the listeners, again, I want to say, please check this out. This is everything Gandhi said is going to happen someday. And Mel and David and Mary Lou started it. Like before, in a civilian way, without governments and the UN. And now it's really blooming. So tell me all about the Nonviolent Peace Force from then to what it's doing these days. And presume people don't know too much about it.
Well, at that point, we started bringing this idea to people in various parts of the world, like yourself and like many people, maxing out both of our credit cards, David and I. And what we found, like your reaction, was that this was not a new idea, and that many people from Gandhi on had been trying, experimenting, dreaming, writing about this idea. And so rather than being founders, we were holders of the vision. And we could hold the vision long enough to bring a circle of people from around the world who had experience, who knew what they were doing, to come together in 2002 and form Nonviolent Peace Force. And at that event, Ela Gandhi was one of the people there. And at that event, at the end, we all went to the place where Gandhi had been assassinated.
In New Delhi. And she was Gandhi's granddaughter.
Mm-hmm. She's
still alive, yeah.
And we walked by on the footsteps that are marked out in the lawn and passed the modest marker and paid our respects. There were 150 of us from 49 nations. And then people fanned out on the lawn and started praying and singing in their native languages. And there was a brilliant cacophony. And then Ela spontaneously stepped forward and started reading from her grandfather's work. And then she closed out and said, "My grandfather would be very happy today." That is how we began.
Wow.
And from that time, we have taken and shared and moved and shaped this vision of how you confront violence with strategic, disciplined nonviolence. It's not that you just go in there and sing a song. It's that you're well-trained in methods that have been shown to work, that you work closely with local groups because they, of course, are the experts on what's happening, and they have to be our guides. And we work in team with them to first provide the direct protection when people are under threat, because civilians are the major casualties of war, and then also working with local communities so they can get back to that level of harmony where they no longer need any kind of outsiders to support themselves. And so we have used, now we've had thousands of people over the last 25 years who have come forward and worked in violent conflicts and have learned and have brought those skills back to their communities. They've come from all over the world, and that continues to happen. I retired from Nonviolent Peace Force almost 3 years ago, but they're very active. As you mentioned, they're on the front lines in Ukraine. They're in the Philippines. They're in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They're in South Sudan. They're working on the California-Mexico border, and they continue. But excitingly, is there are over 60 other civil society groups that are now doing this kind of work. in at least 24 areas of the world. And that number continues to grow.
That's very exciting. So tell us briefly how you train people to become unarmed civilian protectors. It's a little more serious, I dare say, than the Peace Corps. You know, do they come for a month together somewhere or 6 months, and then they commit for a year or two to South Sudan? How does that work?
Yeah, it really varies. When we started Nonviolent Peace Force, it was a commitment to 2 years. And we do pay our people because they have to be able to support themselves and their families. It's a living wage, but certainly not an enriching wage. And we do support them in terms of their room and board and transportation. They initially start out with a online training that is available. The manual is on the Nonviolent Peace Force website. And now NP has developed a Unarmed Civilian Protection Academy. And so if you go to their website and look at the academy, they have a abounding resource list of all kinds of documents and training materials that are available that continue to be generated in multiple languages around the world. So people take part in the online training, and then they take part in the face-to-face training where they learn, first of all, the basics of nonviolence. And we tend to stress Barbara Deming's two-hand approach of that we, with one hand, will resist the injustice that you do, but on the other hand, we reach out to the humanity that is in every one of us. And then we teach the principles, which include nonpartisanship. While we are not nonpartisan when it comes to international humanitarian law or the violations of the basic laws that are happening today, we do not take sides in terms of conflicts. Now that has become more difficult and more challenged today as we work in not use NP, but as I've worked in Palestine and as NP has worked in Ukraine, where it's impossible to talk with the adversaries. And another basic principle is the primacy of the local actor, that it has to be the local people who are shaping the strategy and how it's carried out. Wow. Then from there, people are trained in what now is 12 basic methodologies that are used and applied to various stages of conflict, depending on what's happening at the time. And then from that, people learn to do conflict analysis so they can analyze a conflict and understand whether one does interpositioning or one does accompaniment or one needs an early warning, early response kind of mechanism that's set up. And also, we spend a lot of time on team building because this is not a lone wolf operation. Hmm. This is people working together.
So I'm such a big believer in this. I want to ask you, how can our listeners learn more and support Nonviolent Peace Force and other groups providing unarmed civilian protection? Because it's going to have to become even more needed as hopefully we move, as Gandhi would say, toward the abolition of war. And eventually all the governments in the world start creating nonviolent civilian-based defense systems that all conflicts around the world will be resolved nonviolently. We won't be bombing and killing people anymore or having drones or anything. So how can people help out?
Well, there's a number of ways. they can go to the website of nonviolentpeaceforce.org. And as I mentioned, there are a number of other groups. We've come together and work in a community of practice that includes, for example, Peace Brigades International, PBI.org. There's the Mobile Peace Team that used to be Meta Peace Team. They changed their name because of someone else took the name Meta. And so now they're Mobile Peace Teams. There's the Ecumenical Accompaniment Project in Palestine and Israel. There's the Community Peacemaker Teams. There's all of these groups that do rely upon people to come forward and volunteer to serve as unarmed civilian protectors, but also to serve in other capacities. We need people who can help do public education, who can help to build the structure that's necessary to sponsor events, so that people do understand that this is a real and practical approach to dealing with violent conflict. And it's here. It is here and now. It's like those cenotes in Mexico, you know, the underground rivers that occasionally they come above ground and you'll see a lagoon or a stream and then they go back underground. So a lot of this has been underground, but now they arise in cenotes and people are starting to see, oh, there it is. That's happening. That's real.
Thank you. I hope everyone can learn about it. Well, there you are, retired. And so last year you went to live and work in Palestine for 6 months. And as some friends know, that last fall an Israeli settler beat you up and you ended up in the hospital where you had surgery. This was all part of the Unarmed Civilian Protection in Palestine group. And let me give you everybody their website. It's ucpip.org. That's Unarmed Civilian Protection in Palestine, UCPIP. And tell us about your time there and also what happened.
Well, we started out organizing, doing an assessment throughout the West Bank and talking with people also in Gaza. And from that, we learned two very important things. The first one was that there is a desperate need for large-scale unarmed civilian protectors, especially people from the international community, as well as Israelis. Secondly, that there were at least 22 organizations already doing some form of civilian protection in the West Bank. And many of these groups didn't know each other, didn't coordinate, few had much training. And so our work was both to organize a team of internationals and Israelis, and also to start to bring together people so that we could coordinate and train and be more effective.
That's beautiful, man.
And one of the things, John, that I really want listeners to know, and that is that there are hundreds of Israelis who are in the West Bank every day, side by side with me and others, protecting Palestinians and risking their lives. And that's a story that's not told. Mm-hmm. But they are there at great risk. Two of my colleagues got severely beaten, two Israelis, by settlers just a few weeks ago, and they're there. And so that this is a partnership, really, and a growing understanding in Israel as well. And it's certainly not close to a majority, but people are stepping up, and we need to encourage that.
Thank you. Well, you've spent 6 months there, and the whole world is following the horrors of these last years, but the occupation's been going on for 75 years and more.
That's right.
So let me ask you, in your own words, from your own experience and suffering over there, What are you hearing from the Palestinian people? What is their message for us here in the United States? And what can you suggest? I know this is a mouthful, but take it whichever way you want. How can us ordinary people here in the U.S. nonviolently resist the U.S.-backed Israeli occupation of Palestine, the U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza, and all the ongoing injustices and apartheid and killings happening there?
The first thing that I hear often, and I'm in contact with my colleagues almost every day, is listen and act. The violence has intensified greatly since the attacks on Iran and Lebanon. That fog of war has provided the cover for the Israeli settlers and the Israeli army to increasingly and brutally attack civilians. And for example, I stayed in a beautiful Bedouin village in the Jordan Valley. We were 10 kilometers from where Jesus was baptized in the Jordan River. Every morning I could look up and to my right, see the distant skyline of Jericho and the Mount of Temptation. And there we were, right in the place where Jesus walked, in the beautiful sand mountains in the desert. And we were in a village of 130 families of Bedouin shepherds. And all they wanted was to herd their goats and their sheep and to raise their families and send their children to school. And we encountered attacks at least twice a day. This was, in all my career, the most intense violence I've seen, that two to five times at any time of the day, we would encounter settlers who were often backed up by either the Israeli army or the Israeli police. And one night I got up and it was 2:30 in the morning. I had to go to the toilet and I looked and there was movement on top of a ridge. And I went and woke up one of my colleagues, and she and I went out and we shined our flashlight up on the ridge. And I said, "Chloe, there's four horsemen coming at us, you know, apocalyptically."
Great. Yeah.
And she said, "No, Mel, it's three. The fourth one's a shadow." And I thought, "Oh, great." And here were these masked settlers galloping towards us.
Wow.
You know, at 2:30 in the morning. And so we went and woke up the rest of our colleagues and got every form of light we could, and because they don't like light, and shined light on them and said, "Go back to bed, you know, get some sleep, get out of here." And they, you know, pranced around and like the KKK and for a few minutes, and we just kept not making a big deal out of them and saying, you know, "Get out of here, get some sleep, go to bed." And then they finally left. But they tried to intimidate. And that violence now, as I experienced, has turned into direct assaults. And those assaults are becoming more and more gruesome. If people look at the column that Nick Kristof wrote in the New York Times a week ago Sunday about the sexual torture that's going on, it is just hideous. Mm. And so what can people do? First of all, pray without end, pray with our feet, as Rabbi Heschel says. And then there's a number of things. We all live in this country in states that have pension funds, and most of those pension funds are invested heavily in Israel and in companies that are doing business in Israel. For example, Minnesota is invested in a company that manufactures white phosphorus, one of the most hideous chemicals that exists on this planet. And white phosphorus to go to Israel. And so we can all work with the state pension boards to divest from Israel and from those companies doing business with Israel.
That's very helpful.
Now, this isn't new to people our age. Mm-hmm. I worked on this in the mid-1980s mm-hmm. with South Africa and apartheid.
Right.
And, you know, lots of people opposed us. But if you ask today, if you go into a group and say, how many people here supported apartheid South Africa? No one will raise their hand. Just like today, there's lots of people opposing us. And in 10 or 15 years, if we go into a room and say, how many people supported the Netanyahu right-wing government of Israel? No one will raise their hand. And so we have to push through and working on divestments. Secondly, the elections, the midterms are coming up. Every member of Congress and a third of the Senate is standing for re-election. We have to hold them accountable for these undeclared wars that are going on, that are killing people and just making life so hideous for so many people. I just heard this afternoon that the World Central Kitchen today announced that they had to cut the number of meals that they're giving out in Gaza in half, from 1 million to 500,000, because they can't afford the fuel and the costs that have been increasing since the war on Iran. And so to stop that war on Iran and Lebanon, but at the same time to stop the genocide in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing that continues in the West Bank.
So, Mel,
So
you're from St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and you returned home injured to surgery from Palestine in November, and you're recovering, and then you find yourself in another occupied territory with the horrific ICE raids and the killing of Renee Good and Alex Priddy, and I know you jumped into involvement there. So tell me a little bit about your experience in these last 6 months in St. Paul, Minneapolis, especially after all you've been through in Palestine, but your whole life work to teach nonviolent intervention.
Little did I know that I would leave one occupied territory and come home to another. But I arrived in St. Paul right after Thanksgiving, and here was ICE increasing and Metro Surge was on. And so we saw thousands of ICE agents in the streets, just plucking people. Any person of color was being stopped, interrogated, taken out to the federal building, flown to Texas, kids were being flown to a camp in Michigan, no accountability whatsoever. And what happened, and I've never seen this in my entire life, is that there was a lot of good organizing. So, for example, Unidos, a group that comes out of the Latino community and actually comes out of the Dreamers, they started organizing in September what they called constitutional observers. The video constitutional protectors who had been trained provided immediate evidence that showed that Secretary Noem, that Stephen Miller, that other people in the Trump government were simply lying. And that was out there plain for everyone to see. So there was that organizing that was going on, John. But there was also multi-leveled organizing. In addition to that, there were people that were patrolling the streets of St. Paul and Minneapolis 24/7, who were organized, who were set up on a signal dispatching teams. There was a database that was created of license plates and makes and models of ICE cars so that we could check when we saw something suspicious. And so people were circulating 24/7. And in Minneapolis, it got to the point where if ICE encountered someone, the response time was 2 minutes. And all of that led to ICE leaving finally.
So this works. Yeah, this organized nonviolence works.
It sure does. There were thousands of people like myself who were showing up twice a day at the schools and just providing a presence there. And that really was a deterrent and in many cases stopped ICE from coming to the schools and grabbing students. There were others who were giving people rides to work. And if families could not work, could not leave the house, people were bringing groceries, people were paying rent, people were picking up laundry and doing laundry. People in groups were going to immigrant-owned businesses and making it a point to shop there. There were protests every day. In fact, even today, my neighbors every day at 4:15 go out for a vigil.
It's very inspiring. We're going to have to wrap it up soon, but I wanted to ask you briefly, because this podcast is called The Nonviolent Jesus, with all you're doing, you're just living his life. I wanted to just ask you briefly to share a thought with our listeners about the nonviolence of Jesus and maybe what that means for you and your hope for how Christians can engage, as you have, in unarmed civilian protection like Jesus did, saving so many people, starting with the woman in the temple, for example.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it goes to the Beatitudes, which as a boy I took seriously. And I went through the list and thought, well, I think this is pretty clear about how we're supposed to live.
I think so too. I think you're onto something there, Mel.
And that also, that knowing that the kingdom of God is here and now, and it's not a place, it's a consciousness in all of us. And we need to recognize it. And when we recognize it, really lift it up and reinforce it in each other. And there are so many dark times and suffering, but realize that during that time, what brings us together is grief-soaked surrender. It's our weaknesses that bring us together.
Would you have a final word of encouragement for our listeners? I noticed in your recent newsletter, you ended with a quote from your friend who said, "Even when it's hopeless, you resist, because it's our basic humanity, it's our self-respect." What last word of encouragement might you have for us to keep going and resisting and doing what we can?
That even when it's hopeless, and for the first time in my life, I did experience hopelessness, we can continue on. And that in sometimes hope is a luxury, but there's something beyond that, that there's something that the darkness is not empty, that we can continue on and we can hold on to each other and do things as Jesus showed us. And they aren't easy, but they're much easier than what is unfolding right now.
Mm-hmm. Amen, brother. Well, Mel Duncan, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and thank you for all your good work. And everyone, please check out nonviolentpeaceforce.org. Thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. And you can hear other episodes and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org. And there you can sign up to receive our free newsletter with news about other upcoming podcasts and guests and Zooms. And please tell your friends and coworkers about this podcast and spread the good word. Hope you also check out my new book and get it, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. If you're on Substack, you can look me up at Father John Deere. May the God of peace bless you all. Let's all keep following the nonviolent Jesus, do what we can to resist war and injustice, and welcome God's reign of universal love, compassion, and peace on earth. See you next time.